Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 157 of the Hot Rod and Dragster Show, still officially known as the Bugle. But, John, I reckon we need a bit of rebranding. We need to soup up the Oliver Zaltzman brand. And Hot Rod and Dragster, I mean, that's a strong double act name, that is.
Which one am I?
Well, you are Hot Rod.
Oh, OK. I wanted to be Dragster.
You can't have that, mate. That's mine. Andy the Dragster Zaltzman. That's me, life in London. Former European shark dressage champion. It's one thing to ride a shark, John. Quite another thing to ride it accurately. And here I am in the Chris Akabusi Memorial Recording Studio in Wapping. And in New York City, live, or if not live, then certainly sounding pretty chipper for a dead guy, it's the Rampaging Enchilada himself, John Hot Rod Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. Andy, I did a couple of gigs last weekend, and one of them was in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is so much more majestic than the Bethlehem that Jesus was born in. Did you know, Andy, that the Bethlehem in Israel doesn't even have a Sands casino? Well, the one in Pennsylvania does. Just what Jesus would have wanted. I'm telling you, if Mary had been wandering around on a donkey in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, not only would they not have turned her away, they'd probably have comped her room too and thrown in a free breakfast. The great thing about this particular gig was it was in a new art centre that has been built in a converted steel plant. And the back of the stage was just one massive window looking out onto this huge abandoned steel factory. And it was like doing a gig in front of a visual representation of the decline of American industry. It was great to have an air of tangible sadness in the gig whenever the audience looked slightly over your shoulder. Oh, we used to produce things, didn't we? Oh, still, an art centre's nice too. But we're very lucky, Andy, that I have anything at all to say this week, because I was writing some ideas late last night at work, suddenly realised that the computer I was working on at work was getting a virus. Something had popped up about a hard drive issue. I clicked OK and immediately regretted it. And from that point on, I was desperately trying to email myself the document before the entire computer shut down. I felt like Indiana Jones as the rock got larger and larger behind him. But I actually managed to get the email off, and literally seconds later, the screen went black. That would be a much more realistic plotline, I think, for the next Indiana Jones movie, Andy. An old Indiana desperately trying to fight a virus on the computer in his retirement home.
So that's quite a backdrop for a gig. I think we might have talked about this before on the Bugle, but do you remember that gig we did at the Frontline Club? In fact, I think we put out the recording of it, didn't we? And we were performing comedy, Trivialising the World, in front of a photograph of an Israeli tank.
You got to laugh.
That's right. You don't have to, but I guess it is one option.
I think the Israelis had argued that tank was just there for decoration anyway. It was an ornament tank.
So this is Bugle 157 for the week beginning 13th of June 2011. 157, of course, you don't need me to tell you, it's the world record number of consecutive swear words by a sitting head of state. Set by Gerald Ford when receiving responses to his "he'll back me in a nuclear strike on Canada" request at the United Nations. 157 no's, then at last, there we go, he said. I knew one would come through for me. I just didn't expect it to be Canada. And this is the week beginning Monday the 13th of June, meaning it is happy 2111th birthday to little Julius Caesar. Former world number one ranked Roman. And to coincide with this once-in-a-death-time moment, a rash of new historical pun-themed sitcoms are to hit the airwaves this week, including Julius Caesar, a quirky, oddball sitcom about 30-something Julia, whose hopes for the future are put in jeopardy by a major medical incident. And World War Juan, a sizzling comedy about an angry young Spaniard who wants to thrust the entire planet into another global conflict. And the schemes he concocts to foment unrest and political conflict around the world. And there's this one, Sophie et Tuna Young. Sophie et Tuna Young.
Oh boy.
Yep.
Oh
Sophie
boy.
Is a modern woman in search of the ultimate culinary experience, held back by the fact that as a 5-year-old, she ate tuna fish and didn't like it.
Wow, there was a drop-off after World War Juan there.
And finally, Rushing Rev Alushans. The always-in-a-hurry priest refuses to eat Indian potato dishes. There we go. Well, it's been a tough week for me, John. I've had a few domestic things to deal with. And I'm afraid that's when I take refuge.
That's when you need the pun.
And a section in the bin this week, going straight in the bin. This week's section of the Bugle is an attention-seeking supplement, including teach yourself to hyperventilate on demand, how to ruin a funeral without unnecessarily streaking, how to be the centre of attention without taking hostages, and confessing to a crime you didn't commit, the do's and don'ts. Do try to make sure that you admit to a crime that is not a capital offence, and don't admit to it in Saudi Arabia. And finally, is ostentatiously wearing fur as a fashion statement morally okay if the animal is still alive? In the bin this week.
Top story this week. Freedom! We won't let you down, freedom. Though actually we might let you down, freedom. In fact, we are definitely going to let you down, let you down. Middle East uprising update now.
What's that? I don't know that song.
George Michael?
Yes, you do.
Oh,
yes,
right.
You do, Andy. It's a George Michael classic.
Oh, it's my school song, actually.
When you say you don't know a song like that, you lose musical credibility, Andy. Not everything is Bon Jovi and Boney M.
Well, I'm flattered by the suggestion that I had musical credibility before that.
If it helps, it was Robbie Williams' debut solo single as well, Andy.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Right.
Now, Chris has lost musical credibility by going the other side of knowledge now. Anyway, Andy, freedom! That was the cry of William Wallace Braveheart shortly before the British tore him limb from limb. And if you think about it, in many ways, he got his freedom, Andy, as we generously liberated his extremities from the oppressive ties of his torso. And did he say thank you? Did he f***? He just died, the ungrateful Scot. Well, that cry of freedom has been sounding out across the Middle East over the last month with similarly brutal results. It's like the dictators of the world once went to a hypnotist show, and the hypnotist told them that if they ever heard the word freedom, they should cluck like a chicken and open fire on their own people. Well, we in the rest of the world have been trying so hard to ignore what is happening in Syria, Yemen and Libya as much as we can. It's like that amnesty technique that adults sometimes use with children. I'm going to turn my back, and when I turn back around, I want to see a stable democratic government here. Except this time, whenever we turn around, it's just Gaddafi flipping the bird and pointing at his own bare ass. I guess the big takeaway is, it does seem that we are currently in a lot more wars than we're giving ourselves credit for. We're running a pretty impressive number of explosive physical discussions with countries in and around the Middle East. The problem is that we're being extremely careful not to call anything that we're doing a war. They're either humanitarian interventions or kinetic military actions or covert operations, but there are so many of them happening now that we're going to need to invent more euphemisms for war, and we're going to have to do it fast. So, Yemen news now! And Andy, in Yemen, we're involved in a spot of what I believe the potential UN resolution describes as violent nudging. Just throwing a few ballistic elbows to knock them back onto the right track.
That's a good way of putting it, John. And it's also, I guess, you know, that we've been previously nudging them by giving them lots and lots of weapons in exchange for lots and lots of Yemeni money. So.
Yeah, that's right. We're no stranger to the nudge.
Yeah. So, I mean, it has led to... There's been... I can't say I've fully followed the Yemen crisis. I mean, there's been a lot of sport on this year, John. So,
right.
I mean, things have to take priorities. But it does seem...
I don't think the Yemenis would blame you for that.
It does seem that there have now been more resignations than at the World Pessimism Championships. Does that quite work? I think that nearly works. I think that's just close enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I could probably have worded it better with a bit more time, but I'm just going to have to do.
I think what happened with that joke, Andy, is it's like in the semi-finals. You're an Olympic sprinter who has just placed, so just getting through to the final, but in the knowledge that you are going to arrive last. The Obama administration has been increasing airstrikes on suspected militants in Yemen in an attempt to keep them from gaining power while the government teeters. And a US official confirmed that a strike last Friday killed Abu Ali al-Harith, a mid-level al-Qaeda operative, which followed last month's attempted strike against Anwar al-Awlaki, the leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So, just to be clear, are we now fully admitting that we are trying to assassinate these people? Or are there still those strange excuses afterwards? Oh, it was an accident. We were carrying a bomb on a plane and we hit some turbulence and it must have just dropped on his house by mistake. We're very sorry and very embarrassed. Or maybe it's... Oh, we saw through a drone camera that there was a wasp on his nose. And you know, we didn't want him to get stung. We know he's allergic to wasps. So we launched 3 missiles at his house to scare the wasp off.
Or well, maybe that they've been hacking his emails. And they'd found out that he wanted to have a new patio put in, merely helping him out by flattening his garden. And
that is entirely possible.
We can't rule
now,
that out.
We've been doing this secretly, although I don't know how secret anything can be when there's a huge explosion at the end of it and a crater in the ground where a building used to be. But we've also been doing it with the covert support of President Ali Abdullah Saleh, the brutal, repressive leader of Yemen. And he's actually been a bit quiet this week, President Saleh, because last Friday he came down with a very nasty case of being blown up by a bomb. And there's a lot of that flying around the region's leaders at the moment. It seems to be very contagious. It was initially reported as a rocket attack by rebels, but was later revealed to be a bombing at a mosque inside his palace. And apparently he's been in intensive care in hospital in Saudi Arabia since then and has had shrapnel removed from his body, as well as suffering 40% burns. But President Saleh has already said, Andy, that he's coming back. And I definitely wasn't expecting that, Andy. I was expecting him to pull a Musharraf there, realise he's got no more chips and walk away from the table. But instead, he's gone outside, he's stolen a bunch of car keys and is now pushing them towards the dealer and doubling down. He's in it to win it, Andy. 40% burns to the body. He could be Yemen's first bionic president, emerging from the smoke with a digital eye scanning for dissidents. His supporters have been playing down his injuries, saying he's overcome the health difficulties after successful surgery to remove shrapnel. Sources expected him to return soon after completing his recovery and treating some light surface burns. Light surface burns? Presumably, those are the ones on the surface of the 40% massive burns all over his body.
I don't know, John, if you had a steak with 40% burns, it would still be pretty rare, wouldn't it? I mean, maybe that's the angle they're going with there.
His supporters fired shots into the air on Thursday to celebrate reports that he would soon return to Yemen. And this might actually be the best way for President Saleh to gauge who's a supporter of his and who's a rebel, by just seeing which angle the bullets are flying. Are they going up in the air, or are they flying towards his head? That could be the key.
That's how I certainly do it at gigs. And in Syria, John, it's a pretty messy situation in Syria. President Assad is certainly living up to the first syllable of his name. And, of course, it's hard to know exactly what's going on because the Syrian government has refused to allow most of the foreign media access to the country, although it did say that the Bugle could go in. But, unfortunately, I've been busy this week and John's a chicken. Chicken! So, grow a pair and get over there. But anyway, so once again, the United Nations, John, has sprung into action like a coiled donut and has responded to the unfolding catastrophe in Syria by debating with itself whether or not to tell Syria that it's being a bit naughty. Now, understandably, such extremely strong words have caused a split in the UN Security Council, and Brazil, China and Russia have said that they're worried about hurting Syria's feelings at a time when it's really not feeling very good about itself already. Brazil have suggested a compromise whereby any resolution is delivered to the Syrian government in the form of a video of kids juggling footballs on the beach at Rio de Janeiro. China has offered to deploy 2,000 peacekeeping infantry troops, but only ones made of terracotta. And Russia wants to airdrop vodka over the entire country to help it drink its way through its problems. Funny how countries always fall back on what they know best in times of crisis. We in Britain, we've offered to send in Vera Lynn. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but there is a possibility that it might be in a few years' time in The Hague.
In Syria at the moment, there is clearly a looming humanitarian crisis on a very depressing scale. Of all the global cities that you do not want to be living in at the moment, the town of Jizir al-Shagur is right up there. And in real estate terms...
Is it worse than Derby?
I think it is, Andy.
Really?
In real estate terms, it's very much a buyer's market there. To put it indelicately, there may be some unexpectedly open plots of land to build on there very soon. The problem is that 120 Syrian troops were reportedly killed there over the weekend in protests, and the authorities have made it clear that they will act decisively and forcefully to restore control. And just to be clear about quite how chilling that statement is, when President al-Assad acts decisively, things get broken. When he said he was going to change the TV channel decisively, he ordered tanks to open fire on his television set, then bought himself a new plasma screen that was preset to the channel he wanted instead.
Yeah, the army are now advancing on Jizr al-Shagur after what it claims was a lethal attack by rebel protesters on government troops, which others have claimed was a lethal attack by government troops on government troops who didn't want to launch a lethal attack on rebel protesters. And it's left many fearing a repeat of the 1982 Hama massacre when the current president's father ordered a scorched earth policy resulting in the deaths of tens of thousands of his own people. But still, John, these people should count themselves lucky. They don't know how good they've got it, being fired on by their own military, hounded from their homes, having their electricity, water and food supplies cut off, because at least they did not have to go through the soul-shattering trauma of applying for loads of Olympic tickets, but not getting very many of them due to overwhelming public demand and the random nature of a balloting system.
Oh, Andy, I'm sorry.
But it's time we in Britain...
I'm sorry, Andy.
We need to rise up, John. Yeah. We cannot sit back and take this kind of oppression any longer. What about our human rights, John? What about my fundamental right to pay over the odds to watch minor sports I habitually have no interest in? Where is Amnesty International now, John? It's all gone f***ing quiet. Sod Syria, there are loads of Arab nations, but there's only one London Olympics. And for too long, people selling sports tickets to us have told us how to live our lives. But no longer, Britain. Rise up! Let's lay our own eggs, wield our own spoons, and hold our own People's Olympics. Even if the IOC's armed forces try to stop us and the government suppresses the foreign media from reporting it. We have to take a stand, John. These people in Syria are frankly eating a very friendly omelette by comparison with what we in Britain have been through this week.
Libya news now, and in Libya, Gaddafi is clinging onto power like an angry limpet. More of his close advisers have recently defected, and he seems increasingly isolated. But that has not stopped Captain Crazy from doing what he does best, ranting incoherently about how fantastic he is. I've said it before, Andy, and I'll say it again. He's like a West Coast rapper with an even larger sheet of murder charges. He even appeared on state television this week, defiantly stating that he was going to fight to the death, or, more specifically, as he put it, we will stay dead, alive, or victorious. That's an odd third option, Andy. You would usually take the dead there as being defeat, and the alive as being victorious. What he seems to be suggesting is a third eventuality where he is neither dead nor alive, but victorious. Now, what's he saying, Andy? Is he going to morph into some kind of permanent vapour that hangs over Tripoli, therefore never leaving and claiming victory? Is he going to clone himself until Libya's population is entirely made up of 6.5 million Colonel Gaddafis? Or is he going to turn himself into a plant? A Venus flytrap whose roots run deep throughout Libya and who can capture American planes in its mouth, swallow them and dissolve them in its stomach for nutrients? Or is there a fourth option, Andy, that being that Colonel Gaddafi does not know what the f*** he is talking about? He may also be about to have less money, mo problems, as an internal management document of the Libyan Investment Authority was leaked, leading to the location and freezing of $53 billion of Libyan state assets. Apparently, on June the 30th last year, $293 million of Libyan state money was on deposit in various HSBC accounts. A further $275 million was in an HSBC hedge fund. $110 million had been invested in private equity funds managed by the Royal Bank of Scotland. $182 million was in Goldman Sachs accounts and funds. The French bank Société Générale received $1.8 billion of Libyan Investment Authority money in three different funds. Wow! Gaddafi's online banking must be a nightmare, Andy. I hope he switched to paperless statements. How the f*** Does he remember all his passwords? And what does Libya have in his PayPal account? It must be huge. All of these assets have now been frozen under orders from the European Union and the United Nations. So we've basically taken his credit card away, Andy. We've cut it up in front of him, Andy, like a bratty teenage girl. You can't be trusted with this, so let's see how you get along without it. It's time for you to learn some lessons about what life is like in the real world. And true to form, I'm guessing that Gaddafi has responded like a teenage girl as well, running upstairs, slamming doors and throwing a tantrum. I can't believe you're doing this to me! You've ruined my life! I hate you! And you know what, Andy? I blame ourselves. You know, by allowing him all that money for all those years, we have raised a loathsome brat.
That's right. We only encourage his bad behaviour.
Exactly.
You're going to make a great dad, John. Keep it in your trousers, update, brackets, and don't post it on the internet. That's phase two of the keep it in your trousers.
Who'd have thought that was going to be a refillable segment, Andy? I've got a feeling that we're going to be whipping this segment out a few more times over the next years.
Yeah, another prominent public figure is on a long, epic journey of recovery back to respectability. Another personal peeniad. And some things in life are inevitable, John. There's some things we just can't avoid. And if your name is Congressman Wiener, I'm afraid your fate is pretty much sealed, John. Rather like the old and very unsuccessful Israeli boxer, Chaima Punchbag.
Oh, my God. Did you give yourself a high five after that, Andy?
I gave myself a low five, John, and a telling off. It's been a tough, been a very tough week. But, yeah, Wiener... Anthony Weiner, now known as Tiny Tony, has admitted that pictures which he denied were of his penis were, in fact, of his penis. He said, the picture was of me, and I sent it. He posted it on Facebook. What he actually meant by those words was, the picture was of a specific part of me, my penis. Yes, my Weiner, as the British would say, my right honourable member for Knutsville North. Yes. I, a 46-year-old husband of a pregnant wife and 5 times re-elected congressman, took photographs of my Wang Dang Doodle. I knowingly pointed a camera at Lieutenant Colonel Toole of Trouser Company. I put my money on Plonk Down Percy in the 340 Duke of Todgerton Memorial Stakes at Prong Market. And then I put the pictures on the internet. But in mitigation, I've worked hard for 20 years to get where I am in politics, with all the pressure on myself and my family that goes with it. I deserved a treat, and that treat was taking pictures of my penis and posting them on the internet, as all freedom-loving Americans are free to do under the terms of our great Constitution. In fact, all freedom-loving Americans are duty-bound to take pictures of their wangs, or wangettes if they're lady Americans, and post them on the internet. It's what our founding fathers fought for. Anyone who doesn't post a picture of their private parts on the internet is basically a communist. I'm not taking questions by.
He initially said that he'd been hacked. Then he said he could not say with certitude that it was not his penis. Then he yes, that's a direct quote. Then he finally admitted, even though he'd previously admitted it, basically, that it was his wang. And since then, various sexting revelations have come out. And since then, various sexting revelations have been coming out, including him getting involved in a sex chat with one stranger on the internet, Andy, suggesting that they should have sex while watching The Daily Show, which is so creepy. I don't want to dwell on it.
Did they specify which part of The Daily Show?
No. Let's hope it was just the opening credits.
Isn't he an old friend of John Stewart, this guy?
I'm afraid so. That makes it even creepier. Yeah. Although Wiener is currently much more determined to keep his job than he seemed to be around the time that he was taking photos of his junk. Now, he even called Bill Clinton this week to apologise. Bill Clinton is a friend of his family and officiated his wedding, but still, if you're apologising to Bill Clinton over a sex scandal, you are in some serious shit. There have been nothing but wang jokes here all week. And so, you know, we're obviously a little late to this penis party. But I do want to say that, politically, there is no way this is anything new. I'm fairly sure that the desire for politicians to do things as stupid as this has been there throughout human history. Only the technology has changed, making it easier for them to do it. There is no way that during the Second World War, especially the Battle of Britain, that Churchill would not have wanted to blow off some steam, take a photo of his schnauzer and two bulldogs, and text them to every British citizen to boost national morale. Cave paintings were just a way for powerful cavemen of the day to take wang shots. And Caligula's entire time in charge of Rome was a desperate call for the invention of the camera phone. If that technology had been around then, you would have wanted to excavate his phone and then quickly bury it again even deeper. Because it's not the penis shots that would have been troubling there, it would be all the other shit.
Oh, he's been on a visit to a local zoo. Oh. The congressman's penis, of course, was John Grisham's as-yet-unpublished debut novel. And I'm delighted to say that we've got exclusive serialisation rights.
Oh boy, here we go.
Congressman's penis. Chapter 1. It was 4:30 a.m. Sound of a dog barking rent the Philadelphia skies. Mickey Stantonio opened a resentment-filled eye. F***ing dog, he spat, stretching his arms and throwing his novelty doggy alarm clock at the wall. The dog barked again. Balls, frouted St. Stantonio. That was actually a real dog. I'm going to have to buy myself another alarm clock. Stantonio stood up on his bed and bounced up and down, shouting, "Wee-hee!" until he fell awake. That's better, he chuntled. "Good morning, Mickey Stantonio, PR," he greeted himself. The accent slightly changed from the beginning here. It seems
yeah, it has, yeah.
Yeah, I'll stick with it.
Yeah.
Hugging himself like the long-lost friend he was to himself. He looked at his bed. His empty, empty bed. "Oh, my God, where's Janet?" he whispered to himself. Oh, yeah, he remembered. She left me 12 years ago and emigrated to Namibia. Stantonio removed and incinerated his pajamas, bedsheets and teddy bear. No trace of him would be left in this one-star boutique motel. He put the kettle on, took it off again, and chuckled to himself. That putting the kettle on my head joke really works better when someone else has said, "Put the kettle on," before I put the kettle on my head, he admitted, drinking a cup of cold and unbrewed tea. Just then he saw something in the middle of the table. He approached it cautiously. "Shit," he said. "What the f*** is this? It's wooden, flat, seemingly with no writing or distinguishing marks on it. Oh, hang on, that is the middle of the table. But hang on, what's on it?" Stantonio, the 48-year-old private investigator, table tennis aficionado and erstwhile owner of a 5-foot-long iguana, reached out to pick up the unexpectable parcel. "What the f*** is this?" he repeated. He opened the box. His eyes widened each other in amazement at what lay within. "Shit on a pineapple tree," he growled. "It can be, can it? It can. It's a congressman's penis." "But," he growled, "which congressman? And which of his penises? I better take this down to the lab and have it checked out." 20 minutes later, Mickey Stantonio, PI, was sitting in his favourite cafe, Menopausal Brenda's on 13th and Gooch. Before him on the table sat two coffees and a penis. So, Mr. Penis, what's your story?" opened Stantonio, casually flicking a bacon rasher into his mouth. The penis lay motionless on the table. Stantonio thumped an eggy fist on the dispassionately formica surface. "That's your game, is it, penis? I want to know whose penis you are, why you're not on that person anymore, and how you came to be in my hotel room." There was a timbre of desperation in Stantonio's voice that morning. 48, divorced, broke, lonely, and with a congressman's penis staring him in the face over a plate of grits. This wasn't the life he signed up for when he joined the force back in 58. And the last thing he needed, today of all days, was to have to take fingerprints off a congressman's penis. He finished his breakfast, leaving his solitary sausage understandably untouched on the side of his plate. He had his flaws as a man, did Mickey Stantonio, but he also had a sensitivity to the feelings of his dining companions.
What is happening?
"Come on, penis. We're going to get to the bottom of this." Stantonio. "Wait, hang on." Stantonio winked a flirtatious kiss at the chef, apologised, explained that he thought the waitress was still at the till, and promised it would never happen again. He picked up the penis, and he was just to put it back in his glass. He was just about to put it back in his glasses case when, "Wait," said the penis. "There's something you should know." "I'm all ears," said Stantonio, instantly realising the biological inaccuracy of his claim, even as the words were still warm and wriggly in his mouth. The penis took a deep breath. "What I'm about to tell you is going to make Watergate look like a f***ing Taiwanese kid's nativity play." "Awesome," said Stantonio. "Wait till I tell Brenda about this. She's going to come crawling back to me like a slice of cheese." The penis fixed Stantonio in the eye. "I'm not just any congressman's penis. I'm the penis of congressman." And at that moment, a shot rang out. Stantonio jumped behind a coffee machine and held his hands together to form an imaginary pistol and prepared to return pretend fire. Another shot, a door slammed, a car revved. Stantonio emerged. "Kapow! Katwang! Kapow!" he shouted as he gave himself covering fire whilst running back to his table. But the penis, the congressman's penis, was gone. "Man, that is seriously annoying," he said. "Someone knew that penis was here, and I wanted it back. Why?" Chapter 2 next week.
Oh, Andy.
What, mate?
Here's the thing. Here's why you deserve congratulations particularly for that, because it's been a week of Anthony Weiner penis jokes here, and you've managed to tell the one thing that has not been told. Oh, excellent.
I'm desperately wanting to read the rest of this book now.
Oh. Now, Andy, when you say chapter 2 next week, I mean, are you going to deliver chapter 2 next week?
I don't know, John. I don't know. I guess that depends on the response. Let's leave it open to the listeners.
I guess the ball's in Anthony Weiner's court.
I guess we should let Buglers decide. You can let me know via the Twitter feed if you want chapter 2. Or not. At Hello Buglers. It's very dangerous to let democracy into this podcast. British government news now, and I'm afraid that's due to the congressman's penis story. The obviously less important story of the British government and its NHS climb down, and the Archbishop of Canterbury wading into the political discourse and basically chanting at the Prime Minister, "You're not as good as Jesus." That's we're going to have to hold that till next week.
I think it's fitting, Andy, that the Congressman Weiner penis story, which has dominated all news in America this week, is now dominating UK news as well. Your emails now, and we have an email here from Liam in Melbourne under the subject, "An Attack on Australian Culture." He says, "Dear Andy, Chris and John, in order of likely ability to capture, train and ride a kangaroo into traditional Australian warfare..." I can't believe I'm behind you there, Chris. I can't believe that.
It's true.
In response to your recent comments on the Victorian government's recent decision to fine Australians who swear in public, I draw your attention to the following event. And he's linked to a Facebook page where people are planning a protest march. He says, "As you can see, we Australians take our right to swear very seriously. Since Federation, our country has generally upheld the right to freedom of speech, and the iconic image of the Bushman is incomplete without a drawled baga to complement his image. Consequently, many in our society have decided to turn the time-honoured tradition of civil disobedience. We've decided the only rational course of action is to march on the f***ers. I mean, who the f*** do they f***ing think they are? Before some uppity f***ing politician takes away my f***ing right to f***ing swear, we're going to march down the f***ing street, cussing our f***ing mouths off. Yours truly, etc. Liam in Melbourne." Well, listen, Liam, we stand in solidarity with you, in f***ing solidarity. You swear your arse off, Liam.
It's all Australia's got left now after the Ashes. You know, it's all they've got.
God, even just you saying that, Andy, is going to be provoking a lot of swearing over there.
This one comes from Al in London, who writes, "Dear Andy, John, and f*** you, Chris." It's never going to end, is it, Chris?
No.
It's never going to end.
I prefer it when it's just as a name.
Right.
You know...
Right.
At least
when it screamed in anger.
Yeah,
you're
absolutely,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could almost be like a Greek surname. Fuck you, please. Your discussion with the American the other week about where he was when he found out about the killing of global celebrity Osama bin Laden reminded me of a conversation I had with a friend on the very same subject. This friend kindly shared with me the information that he had heard the news on the radio that morning whilst he was, how to put this delicately, taking a dump. Of course, the idea about someone dropping a massive shit in water whilst hearing about a massive shit being dropped in water is funny for obvious reasons.
Yes,
however,
true.
He followed this revelation by relaying to me the conversation he subsequently had with his wife. The people in question will be referred to as Will and Lou, for those are their names. The conversation went as follows. Will, guess who died? Lou, after some thought, Michael Caine? Will, no, it's good news. Lou, thinking again, is it Tony? At this point in the story, it's worth explaining that Tony is her stepfather.
Oh, no.
Will?
Oh, God.
No, not that good. Lou, oh, I don't know, God. You'll have to tell me. Will, Osama bin Laden. Lou, underwhelmed, even disinterested. Oh. So there you have it. Tony, worse than bin Laden. What an accolade for a father-in-law. While I'm at it, can I take this opportunity to congratulate John on eulogy? I got some funny looks on the way to work listening to that one from Al in London.
Oh, that's good.
So there you go. Do let us know, Buglers, if your father or mother-in-law is worse than Osama bin Laden. Oh, and thank you also to all those Buglers who've let us know via Twitter and email about the six giant cocks and balls daubed on school playing fields in New Zealand. And congratulations to those children who've done that.
It's so touching, Andy, that, you know, when an international story like this breaks, you know, you see, oh, look, that school field has got massive outlines of balls and penises on it, that people from around the planet would first think of us straight away. I find that so touching. There's people united together saying, oh, I know who would enjoy that. I've got a lump in my throat just thinking about it.
We've carved ourselves a little niche, John. That's all you can ask for in life.
Yeah, that's right.
So do keep your emails coming in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. Sport now, and the sporting agenda here, John, has been dominated by the continuing fallouts from the Olympic tickets mayhem. And most people have got between naught and around about 15% of the tickets they apply for. Chris, how did you do, mate?
Applied for 600, got naught.
Really?
Mm. Oh, Chris, that is bullshit.
10-minute walk from the site.
But you might even be in it, though. You might be in the triathlon, mate.
I'm still hoping to qualify. Yeah.
And you did a triathlon last week with someone very special, I understand.
Pippa Middleton.
But not only Pippa Middleton. It wasn't just...
Let's hold on. Pippa.
It wasn't just Pippa Middleton in that race. It was also Pippa Middleton's arse, wasn't it?
I believe it came just behind her, yeah. Right. Yeah, close race.
Well, you say, like, 2 minutes behind her.
Closely followed by 5,000 men.
Yes.
Trailing in well outside their personal best.
Yes.
How did she win? How did she win that race?
She just let it be known she was there, and the rest fell into place.
We should enter Pippa Middleton as in all athletic events during the Olympics. No one is going to run around her.
But people are very angry, John, very angry about the Olympics. But the amazing thing, John, is quite how obsessed Britain is with sport. That hundreds of thousands of people are willing to pay 50 quid each to watch a horse shit in a bucket or whatever dressage is. It's amazing. It's amazing. But it's typical, isn't it? British people can't even get tickets to watch, and yet the bloody foreigners are going to swan over here and be right out there in the middle of the stadium, running around, chucking British javelins. It makes me f***ing sick.
What tickets did you get?
I don't know. I got £280 worth of tickets out of an application of about 2,500. But my wife got nothing out of over £1,000, I think. But the important thing is that corporate hospitality is adequately catered for. I think that is the most important thing, and we have to cling to that. So, and if you haven't got a ticket, Buglers, remember, at the end of the day, we'll all be dead within 100 years, so it'll all seem like a lot of fuss about nothing. They even had 50,000 applications to sit in and watch the piss tests. That's the most amazing thing. So I think that's it for this week's Bugle. Thanks very much for listening, Buglers, and we'll be back with Bugle 158 next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.